welcome back to another Frame Voyager Ungraded podcast. Again, playing off of the ungraded camera news, and I probably need to figure out a better way to say that, of this week. And we've got some fun stories this week, and I'm here with a special guest of the podcast, which feels like you're just pretty much on the podcast all the time anyways. Tim Butner, glad to have you back.
Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure to be on it. And I guess I am becoming a regular.
Well, kind of the hope is here to have some rotation of a lot of different people. So when we're talking about camera news, you get a lot of different opinions and, you know, things than just me, because, you know, I don't know everything, obviously, as lots of people like to point out in the comments to me. But
well, the peanut gallery is the peanut gallery.
Peanut gallery is always fun. I mean, hey, you need them. But today we have a lot to talk about. The first story of the video, if you guys are coming from the video, is the deadly Nikon lenses that were found out. I guess it's the, I should know this right off the top of my head, which lens this is. It's the new 400 millimeter f2.8 TCVRS lens, supposedly from Nikon. If you have medical devices, because it uses magnets, some new special powerful magnet to make focus pulling and autofocus much smoother and quicker, it can actually interfere with your pacemaker and your heart, turning it into a magnet mode, which I guess is the mode that it turns on if you go to a hospital or you're having something like done in a surgery where the doctors are like examining it. And it's not a, you don't necessarily want to have it in magnet mode if you're not in a hospital. So pretty interesting. I mean, I've heard of radioactive lenses and some other lenses, and I'm actually reviewing some radioactive lenses that, and actually some of them are pretty dangerous. But it's a little different. I haven't heard of a lens that could literally stop someone's heart. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a new one. I mean, it's kind of funny, but at the same time, like, what?
Yeah.
Why? And I remember years ago, there was like a nuclear thing was found at Kodak, and it was like, oh my God, film's going to go nuclear on digital kind of thing, like kind of jokes, because it was just like, you know, cleaning house at a Kodak factory or whatever, they just found something nuclear related, and it was just like, why? Why would even they need it? So like this whole magnet thing, like why you need such powerful magnets that it could interfere with a pacemaker is crazy. But then who's gonna be in that situation where they, you know, have to worry? You know, it's how many millimeters again is it?
It's a 400 millimeters.
So yeah, that's basically wildlife and sports. So I mean if you're shooting some kind of a car race and all of a sudden you see it, you know, big accident, and you know your pacemaker's going off, but then you have the magnet interfering. And it's, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. They're trying to race to the flaming vehicles, but you're there having a heart attack because of the lens. I mean, yeah.
Oh yeah, that would be man. Yeah, the funny thing is with this is that Nikon literally had to go. Nikon didn't even come out and say this. Nikon rumors found this. They actually went through the manual and they found like the little section on the manual for the lens that I'm sure everyone reads, that, you know, you probably should, if you have a pacemaker, not use this.
So it's in the manual. Is it also the really, really tiny font?
It looks like it. There's a picture of it. And if you watch the video, this video version of Ungraded Camera News on our YouTube channel, we do have a picture of it on there that shows you what they found. It's that small print. So, you know, just telling everyone out there, if you have a pacemaker, if you have any like medical devices or anything, be careful if you get this lens. Now, I'm pretty sure this lens is, I don't know, $12,000 or something crazy like that. So
that seems to fit, because Canon also just released some new zooms that are super expensive, which I think will lead into your other story that, you know, about Canon's lens plans.
Oh yeah. If you don't want, like I said in the video, if you don't want the Nikon death lens, as I'm naming it, Canon has plenty of other choices coming up with their RF mounts in the market. They projected in some kind of like board meeting or something. It's, I don't know. They seem to be pushing out all this stuff like every freaking week. Their new projection from the company shows 32 releases coming through 2025. And this was published as part of Canon's corporate strategy at their conference, I guess, for presentation materials and stuff like that. But yeah, they want to expand the USR lineup, obviously. I mean, it's the new lineup. They already have, I think, 26 lenses. So, but they want to, one of their goals in the actual report was they want to not only be the biggest manufacturer of RF lenses, they want to be the number one mirrorless manufacturer by 2025.
Now that's a bold statement there. Number one mirrorless, yeah. I double checked the Canon RF 800 millimeter, which is 17,000 basically, was recently, you know, announced. It's a new item coming soon for pre-order. And then the 1,200 millimeter F8 lens is like basically 20 grand. So that Nikon death lens is literally probably, you know, so much money that it would give someone a heart attack anyways.
Yeah. So whoever's getting it, well, that's the other thing. Maybe they're having to put it in there because people who would get it, who would have the money to buy, you know, the $13,000-$14,000 lens are kind of, it'll progressed in their career, so probably quite a bit older, I would assume, in some situations. So, you know, they'd have the money to buy it, so maybe that's why there's that warning. It's just, it's funny.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah. Yeah, interesting lenses. Lots of lenses coming out.
Canon needs them because I think we were discussing, you know, the lack of their certain lenses in the market. Like Sony has a lot of third-party companies like Sigma doing for their e-mount, but like right now there's no Sigma RF lenses, so you lack certain primes, and you know even the Canon primes leave room to be desired. So
that's true. So with the Canon, with the RF, because the RF mounts a red mount, correct? Or it's a red patented mount?
No, I think it's a Canon mount that they license to Red currently.
Gotcha. Okay, I got it mixed up. So with that, I'm assuming they have to give patents to lens companies to actually make lenses for the mounts, or can they make?
I think it's a license. I think it's you know, Canon owns the patent. They license. Again, this is something where I would really want to check with like specifically lawyers who patent lawyers who really would understand this stuff. But basically, so the lens manufacturer will design their optics and all the other stuff, but then they will license the mount to be able to do their lenses in that mount. So like they're licensed from Sony, and Sony will allow lens manufacturers to do that because it gives them more, you know, the customers more options for lenses. But, you know, licensing the mount for a camera is where they are less likely to do. With Canon and Red, that specific thing is going with an exchange of you get to do Canon RAW light for your cinema cameras if we can have Canon RF mount on our Red cameras.
Yep.
But then in terms of actual manufacturing lenses-wise, Canon wants other companies to be able to do it so that they have those options. Because, you know, with it right now, you have Canon, obviously. And as I scroll through, I'm right now just on B&H. And just maybe if I see Viltrox, I see Seven Artisans, Venus Optic. Yeah, like there's a little bit more limitation right now of even the third Meek. A has three lenses. Yeah, Lens Baby has seven. Rokinon has three currently. Takina only has one. So, you know, Takina, you think they're pretty big for, you know, all the various lenses that they do. They only have one for the RF mount right now.
Yeah.
So
That is interesting. The RF, well, and you got to think too, with Sony, even with the E-mount, you can still put on other lenses on that with adapters, right? Like I remember being able to put on like EF mounted lenses. I don't know. Can you put on EF lenses onto the RF mounts yet?
Yes. So
backwards? I'm assuming it can't go backwards. If you have an RF lens, you can't go back to EF.
No, you can't. That's got to do with flange distances. So because of mirrorless, you have more option for lens adapters. So Canon RF does have lens adapters. I could actually take my old Minolta lenses and put them through an adapter onto an RF system. Mm-hmm. Or I could even go to Sony and do the E-mount. You know, the lens adapter allows me to have that ability. But yeah, the actual aspect of E-mount always allowed you to be able to do the EF lenses because the flange distance of EF was long enough that you could actually get that adapter.
Yeah. Fascinating. You got to love all the different adapters and the lens mounts and all the stuff they try to make you jump through to get all these different lenses and stuff. It's very interesting. That's why I always loved Blackmagic, where you have the, you know, EF's pretty open now. PL mounts are pretty open. The only thing I guess they don't have is that groundbreaking lens technology, I guess, with RF mounts and stuff. But I mean, certain companies aren't really trying to go for super high-end autofocus lenses anyways. So
not really. I mean, you look at, let's face it, look at Harry. They're just over there sitting in their corner saying, well, we don't care. Then, yeah, when it comes to Blackmagic, you go with the Ursa line. They have interchangeable lens mounts. Specifically, once you got to the Ursa Mini Pro, you know, the original, it was a fixed mount. You could change, like, the mount and the sensor block, essentially. That's how they designed it, because they were supposedly going to come out with new sensors, but obviously that never came to fruition. They had issues. Then the original Ursa Minis, you know, which was the 4K and the 4.6K, they had fixed mounts. So you had either EF or PL options. Then you got to the Ursa Mini Pro, which allowed interchangeable lens mount, which brought them right in line with Arri could have interchangeable lens mounts. Canon kind of does with some of their cinema cameras. You could, can do PL with the, definitely the Mark III C300 and then the C500 definitely. But I don't know 100% with some of the other ones, but nonetheless. And then Red, obviously you could change mounts. I'm trying to think. Sony, I want to say probably, but I'm not sure if it was just, they were just E-mount and it was just the adapter. Right?
Yeah. I wonder, like, at some point, too, is someone going to figure out, like, one device that you can literally just mount on a camera and you can just it'll adjust itself to whatever lens you're trying to connect it to, or if there's any device. And if there was, nah. I mean, yeah, if they could do it, they'd make a lot of money off of it.
They could. Well, again, when it comes to cinema, Arri PL, you know, was 1982. Somewhere in there, like, we're at that point where it's definitely over 40 years where PL has been a standard mount. Before that, it was just the bayonet. All those lenses could be easily adapted to PL. So PL has been around for a long time, and you look at what LPL is doing, it's just a shorter flange distance, essentially. So PL is one of those more standard kind of mounts. And then Panavision Vision has their PV, which I know John Brawley, you know, he's done the adaption. He got Panavision to give him a special PV mount for the Ursa Mini. But other than that, yeah, I mean, Sony's E-mount design always allowed them to do adapters. But I think, I want to say they have had native PL for some of their cameras, like maybe the Sony Venice. Definitely. Yeah. But especially, like, you go back to the Sony cameras that were being, I remember the Sony FX3 had a PL mount, which was when they were still designing their Sony, you know, cinema lenses, which they don't even make anymore. And then all the way back to Star Wars with George Lucas, they had definitely some kind of a PL mount so that he could use PL glass, I believe, for episodes 2, 3.
Interesting. That is interesting. Which it sounds like a lot of these directors and stuff get early access to cameras and stuff and lenses that aren't even available yet. One of the stories I kind of make fun of at the beginning of my video is that it's kind of come into light that the Alexa 65, the first film it was used for was on the Mission Impossible 5. I believe the one with the underwater scene.
Yes, Michelle.
And they used it for the underwater scene. And, like, they had to get Nauticam to build them, like, a housing for it, for a camera that had not been released yet.
It makes sense. But do you know what? Nauticam will do that. You know, they've got a huge, Because I know I saw something where someone was pointing out like them using an alias or two with a Nauticam, and yeah, but it was like this older housing, and they were kind of because film has a reemergence right now, and I see, you know, oh, what's an alias or two like in 2022? How does it compare against an iPhone? And someone actually did a video, and I'm like looking at this going, well,
oh my gosh.
First off, like some of the way that they shot the stuff film-wise, they shot it like a blogger or video blogger, whatever it's called. And it's just, yeah, I know the film could look so much better than this.
Yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, yeah, there's an aspect where Nauticam makes these huge underwater housings. So, of course, you get that contract, they're going to go ahead and put a special team on it. They're going to get it done for a camera that's not released yet, but it's being specially designed. And like Aries, like, hey, Mission Impossible, a huge franchise, Tom Cruise, a big movie star. Ooh, he's specially training to hold his breath for a certain amount of time. Yeah, we want our camera used on this. And then we're going to announce this camera, and we're going to market it, and we're going to use this footage.
Yeah, I just can't imagine being like the DP on this. That's like, and I mentioned this in the video, kind of making fun of it. Like in the boardroom, you're meeting with the director and you're like, yeah, we're going to need the Alexa 65 for that underwater shot. Not for the rest of the movie, just film underwater.
They get it though. These DPs say these things. Think about the fact that Wally Feist and Christopher Nolan for Batman, you know, Batman Returns is a different movie from Tim Burton. Wow. The Dark Knight. Wow. Second Batman movie. Wow. My brain is fucking.
So many of them at this point.
I know. So, but you think about it, Batman Begins, and then you have The Dark Knight. You went from 35 to them shooting certain sequences in IMAX. Think about that boardroom meeting. Well, we want to shoot with those big, clunky IMAX cameras. Aren't they really bad for sound? Yeah, but it's not going to be a problem because, you know, we're going to be dubbing all of his lines anyways because he's using the growly voice. Or you know, like, hey, we're going to do this scene where they're all wearing masks for this bank robbery. Okay, so because they're all wearing masks for this bank robbery, okay, I guess that's how you get around that. It's like, we're going to do this helicopter shot going in, and then we're going to do, like, them ziplining, and it's just like, all this on 15 perf IMAX film? First off, and we know because of, I think it was Dark Knight Rises, one of those cameras being destroyed, that's like, it's a $100,000, $500,000 camera system or something like that, based on the insurance report.
That's where I think the cameras get you with those kind of things, is I think this, the Alexa 65, they don't sell just the body. And they estimate that it's probably around $150,000 just for the body, but you can't just use you have to buy an entire system to even use the
camera. You have to rent it. I don't think it's a purchase. Yeah. I think it's a full-on rental.
Yeah, like you can't even, but they estimate that what it would be around would be that. But yeah, it's insane. I just couldn't, I guess it's good to have this big studio budget, but still just, you know, like with that camera, if it's $500,000, or I guess they have the insurance on it, but like.
But yeah, those big studio movies have huge insurance policies. I mean, of course, look at the new Mission Impossible 7. No. Yeah. Is it 7? Yes. 7. So
the one he was hanging from an airplane or whatever.
Well, no, I'm thinking the newest one that's unreleased. It's because of all the delays. Because 6 was the one where he's hanging from the helicopter, which is at the same. Now maybe that was 5 too. Yeah, he's hanging from the side of the.
Was that 5? Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember. The Halo jump is
number 6. I know that.
Yeah,
but nonetheless, so the newest one is going to be like $300 million because they added on a whole $100 million more to the budget because of the delays from the pandemic.
Yeah.
They had to pay out insurance policies and all this. And also, you know, the Batman, what they ended up dealing with Robert Pattinson getting COVID, the star of the movie got COVID. We're delayed. We're shut down. We can't shoot anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It is very interesting.
I'd love to be the insurance company guys writing those policies. What money they have to be making.
I know, and they're gonna be like, "You're gonna do what with that camera?"
With that camera, okay. Wait, Mr. Cruz, you're gonna be hanging from the side of a building, the tallest building in the world. What? Wait, now he wants to hang on the side of an airplane. Wait, he wants to do what? Can we just say, if he dies, the movie pays out nothing? Because he's putting himself in danger here. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. In terms of the cameras, yeah, it's like, break it. Who cares? You know, what's it? It's money. You know, we snort this stuff into, our noses.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's true. Yeah, and I mean, it would be interesting, which gets us into our next topic, color grading some of this footage, which will become, film and stuff, which brings us into our very terrible transition, but brings us into our new next story, which is the DaVinci Resolve update, which is 17.4.5,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I guess it feels just like a laundry list items of them just like fixing little things here and there and improving a couple different things. We can get into some of that, but yep. It just feels like maybe they're kind of setting the table up for, DaVinci Resolve 18, which I'm assuming will probably be released around the time of NAB, I would imagine.
Traditionally, they announce at NAB with a public beta available, and then it goes through beta, and then the public release is once the beta is done, and then pretty much, that's the stable release. So this is going to be like the final stable release of 17, probably, which is 17.4.5, like you said. And They're addressing just certain things. Send the stage because, anyone who wants to, because you think about this, certain color, the big studios are not going to be participating in the beta. They usually want to have their system locked in. Some of them I know were, we're still on 12.5 when it was like version 15, I want to say. I mean, some of them, because of these major shows, they don't want to update in the middle of a major project.
Yep.
So this will become a stable release, like other than the incremental updates like this. So if they're on 17 already, we'll do this update because it shouldn't negatively affect the project, because usually you have to do a whole database backup before you do the big, from 16 to 17, you want to do your database up, your backup, do the update, and then, everything's working fine, nothing's lost, and then you can continue on. So same with the beta. Beta-wise, we're going to literally see that happen. They're going to announce at NAB, release the beta. They're going to then start getting feedback. Oh my God, this doesn't work. What were you thinking? And this is the thing that's crazy, though. They announce a bunch of features with the beta, and then by they do the stable release, they add a whole bunch of new features, too.
I mean, that's true. I mean, you got to fix the bugs and add the features and stuff. But you hear it here first on the podcast for Frame Forger Ungraded that there will be DaVinci Resolve 18 at NAB. It's guaranteed.
Yeah, it's guaranteed because of the fact that 17, NAB didn't happen in 2020 traditionally. So they were a little delayed with a lot of their releases. But the public beta was at the end of 2020, and stable release was essentially, I think, at the end of 2020 as well, like November period, I want to say, was when 17 was fully stable public release. So we've been over a year of it being a stable 17 release.
Mm-hmm.
So it's at this point, and NAB is definitely happening. No one's pulled out yet.
I know, I'm excited. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be covering it. I'm probably lots of podcasts, lots of videos, lots of, TikToks, whatever, and I'll be wearing I'll probably have some kind of Grant Petty, like, wizard shirt or something. So I have to, I'm going to have some fun there. I'm probably going to be looked at a little strange because all the tech people there, but yeah, it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to NAB.
Well, you should just be like, wait, it's not Comic-Con?
Oh, yeah.
It's a something.
Yeah, I'm going to show up and we're going to have fun. We're going to make some fun content as long as they let
us. Either that or you should dress up in just get a cardboard box, make it up to look like, the box camera.
Oh my gosh. That's... and just have black magic stickers all over.
Yes.
I might do that. Yeah, there's definitely going to be some fun content from there, because I feel like some coverage from there is just super boring in general. So I've been trying to think of some ways to kind of make it spice it up a little bit, have some fun.
All the like interviews are always the same thing, like, too. And you get the camera guys from the companies just spewing the same talking notes with there was a slip up back in 2017, I want to say, where one of the camera guys was being interviewed and he let slip about the Bluetooth being in the cameras, which no one knew about the Bluetooth being in there, because it wasn't until June when they released the firmware that allowed you to control your camera through Bluetooth.
Yeah.
So someone let slip in one of those interviews by accident.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's got to be hard to keep all that information. You're just like, okay, can I only say this? Because you've just been talking about it so much, I'm sure, in all these little meetings and stuff. And then now you can't. Now you have to, like, contain what you're talking about. But yeah, don't worry, I'm gonna ask some fun questions. I definitely gonna have some fun with the Black Magic table, and then, you know, gonna ask them some non-traditional questions. Probably not about camera gear, but it's gonna be. I'll ask about the cameras too, but we'll have fun with them.
Well, especially you should be on them about, like, so when are you gonna integrate into DaVinci Resolve and Fusion, like a 3D compositing program, and Blender, do this, come on, man.
Yeah, I did this video where I talked about, you know, you guys should do this. No mind ask them. I did this poll on our YouTube channel for the community where I asked them what famous wizard would Grant Petty be if he was actually a wizard. Mm. And I think
Gandalf. I want to say I picked Gandalf on that.
If you did, that's 40% pick Gandalf, followed by Merlin, and then 14% Sauron. So
No, I'd say it's more, I came up, Sauron, of course, Lord of the Rings, you know, and all that. But, you know, he was also masquerading as the necromancer. But I was going to say, in terms of a camera company, I would say that's more like Red.
Yeah, that would make more sense. I Gandalf does feel right about for... Is it Grand Petty or Grand Petty? Because he says it and it's spelled like in so many different things, so many different ways. So I never can tell.
But I was going to say, maybe he's more Radagast the Brown.
Ooh, yeah. There you go. that's what I'm going to ask him. I'm going to have a list of questions about what they think. I'm sure I won't get any answers.
Well, you know, the film guys, they might be like, ooh. You know, which wizard am I? Like, you know, like it's more fun for them maybe because it's not the normal type of questions.
Yeah. It would be fun if I got to ask a Grant Petty that. So if you were a wizard, since you have black magic, you know, which one would you most relate with?
Yeah.
But besides the point, we'll be at NAB DaVinci Resolve 18, probably a box cinema camera.
What they doing?
I don't see it coming. I honestly, if I was to guess, I would see the micro cinema cameras coming. They're probably going to refresh that, which I guess you could clarify, you know, as a box cinema camera. But honestly, I think they're going to do something with that 12K sensor, put it in something else that they haven't put it in yet, because you have that new technology and you could adapt it to something like those micro cinema cameras. I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, they could put some of that tech in a smaller form camera like that. It would be interesting.
Well, on the forums, someone recently said, oh, I had the 6K, I went to the 12K, and I was like, wait, none of the images look good, blah, blah, blah. And then once they rethought how they were approaching shooting with the 12K, they love it that much more. They think the image is that much better. So, you know, it's definitely a massive shift because of the way they designed that sensor. And yes, it's a lot more light starved because it's a real proper cinema kind of sensor. Like, you gotta light it like it's a cinema, like it's film.
Yep. Which people don't understand. And it's also, I'm going to make this video here soon talking about why noise isn't as bad as everyone wants to say it is in footage, because you could look at all the movies that try to add noise back into it, or, you know, it's dark scenes. Like, I watch Star Trek all the time, the new Star Treks that Paramount Plus puts out, and in all their dark shots, it's like super grainy. So it's, you know, it's a cinema camera, and raw footage, technically, tends to be more noisy. Yeah. So it's just...
But you know what's interesting is now Greg Frazier has done this twice for two movies, first Dune and now The Batman. They took the digital, they printed it out to film, and then rescanned it so they could get the film grain. Now, two different processes, because they did more of a bleach bypass kind of process for the Batman.
That's what I had heard.
But nonetheless, it's going, they're combining the techniques of, okay, we're going to do digital, we're going to do all this, we're going to color grade it in digital this way, then we're going to go back out to film and then bring it back in. Or I still don't know where the color grading is being done in the pipeline. I feel like some base grade is being done and then they're going to the film and then rescanning it and then maybe doing some more on top.
Yeah, because I'd imagine you'd want to blend in that film, the grain with the footage color too, right? Like, you're probably some post-processing you need to do with that. Yeah, I'd be interesting. I hope they like show some kind of the full end process behind how they do some of that in the movies, because then we could talk about it, because I find it's fascinating kind of combining the digital with the film. And it, yeah, it's pretty cool. And but, you know, speaking, maybe in the future, you know, they might need a little bit beefier of a computer, if you want to call it that, to edit it on. And now I'm, you know, obviously speaking of the new Apple M1 Ultra or whatever.
Ultra. And it's, of course, a box.
Yeah. So the box is in. Box is in. It's in style nowadays, I guess. I don't understand it, but yeah, people like boxes.
I thought we were going... well, no one liked the trash can, so, I mean, I guess we're not going spherical.
Oh, the trash cans. Oh, gosh. But, yeah, this one, it's... I guess they were hiding it from everyone with this M1 until they revealed it, but there's this little part of the M1 chip that was not being used, and... it's actually a connector bridge, so they can connect two M1 chips together to make an M1 Ultra chip or whatever. At least that's how it was explained by Linus Tech Tips. So.
Yeah, that's also kind of how they slightly explained it in their keynote that they did. Yeah, it's interesting. And what's fascinating about that is the question is, does this have it on multiple sides? Is it just one side? So, or is it multiple sides? Because then could you connect four of them? Because they teased... the Mac Pro is the only one left to go to the Apple Silicon, and that is for a later time, is essentially what they said in the keynote. So they teased it. Does this mean they're going to maybe do four of these combined together to make some super Mac Pro?
Yeah, it the tech's super interesting, combining all the things into one thing. It's going to be interesting to see if any other companies come along it. And some of the interesting things I found out about it, I think that they saw that the benchmarking, only the RTX 3090 is faster. It performs better than the 3080. It's that the only thing with it is, again, it's not expandable. Like, you have to buy it as is. You can't do anything extra to it.
You can't replace RAM.
To get storage, it is $2,000 for 2 terabytes of extra storage in this computer. And which means, you know, they're talking about how fast and click, you know, whatever it is. You need fast, high-speed drives for that, which means if you are working on projects, you're still going to need to buy expensive hard drives to go with it and work fast, because you need the read-write speed, like, from the drive itself.
Linus, let me just say this. I'm working on the 27 iMac that is now obsolete, the 2020. And my bog down, hands down, is always the external hard drive. You know, I only put 2 terabytes of internal, because I don't believe in storing projects and working on files that are internal on the computer. I always have been working externally. That's my mindset, because then I put it external and then I back it up. So, you know, I'm using spinning disk hard drive array setup stuff to get the faster read-write speeds. But I'm still noticing a bottleneck, you know, despite the Thunderbolt cables, which are now capable of, you know, 20 to 40 gigabits per second. Guess what? That's meaningless when the read-write speed is barely even a gigabit.
Yep. So, I mean, some of that's great if it's internal, right? If they have it set up internal, or you have a high-end, like, NAS system, or you're having a, you know, SSD, everything. Though, I mean, like, you can still get by. I do get by with a lot of, like, physical drives and stuff, and they work fine. But... the one potential problem, the only thing I heard about this computer that's like, besides the, you know, the extra costs that have to go into it, is that it does have, the way they're making it so fast with the data inside, is that it could lead to potential problems with data integrity, meaning that if your computer shut off accidentally or there's a power outage, the way that they're using the data and storage in your computer to be so quick and snappy could actually cause problems if your computer dies. So Linus Tech Tips had mentioned, you know, you probably, if you're going to get this one, you're going to invest in it, you probably want to have a battery pack backup for your computer if the power goes out that can switch to that so the computer won't turn off if you're doing anything memory related. Other than that, it's a fascinating computer. If I was an Apple person, I would be excited about this computer just because of the price point, because it's not, it has like similar capabilities of that monstrosity, what, $40,000-$50,000 desktop computer that they made a couple years ago or whatever. So
you mean the Mac Pro?
Yeah.
Well, again, this is what's fascinating. So, you know, they had their Cube that they did back in 2000. It's now 22 years later, which was a failure. And they had their towers for the good amount of time, but they also started their iMac line. Now, I remember, you know, a buddy of mine in high school had the iMac, and I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. But, you know, at that time I could only get an eMac. So I got an eMac for my first Apple computer in 2004. And this was a computer where technically you weren't supposed to have an extended monitor. You was only supposed to be able to mirror the monitor. But I took an old PC monitor, got it on, and with a buddy who is a really good Mac expert kind of guy who's now working in IT, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, you know, knows Mac, Linux, and Windows, hands down, all around. Him and I were able to get it so that that eMac could actually have an extended desktop display, something you weren't supposed to be able to do. So kind of a little bit of a hack. But, you know, like then they did their whole Mac PC ad campaign when they did the MacBook Pros, and they went to the Intel chips and they grew a huge amount. You know, there were filmmakers who were using not just Mac computers, but they were using Final Cut. David Fincher, you look back, he was a Final Cut editor, and so were the Coen brothers. You know, you look back to Seven, which, you know, we talked about Batman being very much like a Seven movie right now. Well, guess what? That was cut on Final Cut Pro way back when it came out. And that was on a Mac computer, and then they were, you know, the editor was talking in the video that they put out back then, oh, it's great, I can take the project files home, or I can take things home with me on my laptop, my Mac laptop, work on it, come back, put it back onto the thing, and, you know, oh, we'd be able to just continue on.
Yeah, that is interesting and nice. And you mentioned the external monitors too, and I think who did this? DP Review did a thing where it's capable of playing up to 18 streams of 8K ProRes 422 video at once. And in case you're wondering, that's four videos on each of the four displays and two on a 4K TV.
Yeah, that's insane. Who's doing that?
It's ridiculous.
Other than live television.
Yeah.
Live television is the only... And guess what? Those guys have money for much bigger stuff and hardware to be able to but they have the money for all the hardware to really be able to handle that, where it's like they don't need the little Mac studio to be handling that.
No, at all. But yeah, that's kind of it for this week's news. I'm trying to think of anything else that happens, but I think that about covers it. But
I mean, I'll say this though, with what this Mac studio does do, with being just a little studio thing and now you just have a display option, it means that you're not buying into the built-in iMacs, which are now essentially obsolete, except for they still have the 24-inch.
Yep. I've never really loved those. I know a lot of people do. I'm obviously not a big Apple fan, but yeah. But it's super cool. I have to admit, the very intriguing hardware that they've come out with. I'm surprised that it's something that was much needed from their end because they were losing a lot of ground to a lot of other people. So it's interesting to kind of see.
Yeah, Windows has come a far distance with PCs, and you have third-party companies like HP doing a lot of great things.
But that's it for this week's Frame Voyager Ungraded. Be sure to give us a like, a 5-star rating in the podcast ranking so we can move up. I've heard recently that I was number 8 in Argentina for tech podcasts. I don't know why. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we're a top 10 Argentina podcast.
Does Argentina have an emergent film community we're not aware of?
I don't know. Actually, I have a lot of people from South America that follow the channel, so maybe. It's interesting, but welcome everyone from all over. But
we need a global cinema culture.
We do. We do, absolutely. And that's it for this, again, this week's Framework Drone Creator Podcast. We'll talk to you guys next week. And thanks again, Tim, for being here. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.